And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
And now you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is history. Each of my guests will be discussing something in political, cultural, or business history. My next guest is an expert on China. He'll explain the paradox of how China used capitalism to build socialism and how that resulted in the use of socialism to build capitalism. Confused? You won't be after this interview. As always, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 805-639-0008. Robert Wheel is a senior fellow at the Oakland Institute in Santa Cruz, California. Robert's work at the Oakland Institute focuses on the rapid social and economic changes in China and its relationships to the rest of the world. He's the author of Red Cat, White Cat, China and the Contradictions of Market Socialism. He's the co-founder of the China Study Group, which brings together activists and academics both inside and outside the country. Robert is a graduate of Harvard University back in the 1960s. Robert, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Thank you. Fine. The name's Weil, though.
Weil. I beg your pardon. Robert Weil. Hey, yeah. Nothing worse than mispronouncing your name. I do apologize for that.
It's pronounced both ways, but we, in our family, it's Weil.
You pronounce it Weil, and I'll be sure to pronounce it that way as well. So let's get into it. China is always an enigma to me. Right now, the Middle Kingdom, as China is now known, has a middle class. And the Chinese middle class is larger than the entire population of the United States. By 2025, the middle class in China will be about 800 million people if the current trends continue. In that same time frame, China will have over 200 cities with over a million residents in them. It seems like China's embracing capitalism with a vengeance. So where's the contradiction? I mean, it seems that Maoist communism failed, Deng moved towards capitalism, and now China is in a quasi-capitalist society.
Well, a couple of corrections. One is that 800 million would be about two-thirds of the Chinese population, and I think the possibilities of it depends on your definition of middle class, obviously, but I think that's a wildly speculative figure for where China is moving in terms of building a middle class, because hundreds of millions of Chinese are still extremely either poor or certainly struggling on very low incomes.
And that's certainly true as they live in the countryside, but as more and more of them move to the city for jobs and the opportunities that the cities provide, thereby giving China 200 cities with over a million people, some of that is bound to change, don't you agree?
Well, there have been people in every class stratum in China who have advanced due to the general economic growth and the general economic structure of the country. But if you're working, I mean, you're talking about people moving to the cities. If you're working 80 hours a week in an export factory down in Shenzhen for what used to be $100 a week and maybe now is, $100 a month, and maybe now is up to $130 a month, that's not what I call getting rich. And there are 130, 150 million such migrants in the cities doing construction work, domestic work, and especially these export industry jobs. So moving to the city as such, they may do a little better than they did in the countryside, but they're certainly not moving into the middle class. So, I mean, just that as one perspective. Secondly, you talked about the failure of communism under Mao. I think that's a misrepresentation. The Maoist era, the socialist era, which lasted till his death and maybe a couple of years afterwards in 1976, did not produce the kind of economic growth that we've seen in the last decade or so. But there were enormous advances during that period in China, especially in terms of industrializing. And the main accomplishment was that through collective forms of organization, especially in the countryside, but also in the cities, working people, peasants and workers, able to not only you know, produce together, but they had health care provided, they had job security or income security provided for most of the period, they had educational opportunities, none of which had been available to them under the previous system. And those were enormous accomplishments, most of which have been destroyed in the present system. There's no guaranteed health care anymore. A lot of schools have closed down, et cetera, et cetera. So it depends on what you consider accomplishments. I think providing those kinds of securities to working people is an enormous accomplishment, even if it didn't generate the kind of crazy growth patterns that we've seen since. But the recent growth over the last two, three decades since Deng Xiaoping launched the more capitalistic approach has produced one of the more polarized societies in the whole world today. By some counts, there are more billionaires in China now than in any other country, and yet you still have tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people working under extremely unfavorable conditions. So, you know, there's accomplishments and there's accomplishments. I'm not denying that certain things have happened in China that are very spectacular, but it's come at also very heavy costs in many ways for working people.
We're talking to Robert Weil, everybody, author of the book Red Cat, White Cat. We're talking about China. And, Robert, I would agree that there are all kinds of enigmas in China. But I want to drill down on something you said under the Maoist form of communism and ask you a question of unintended consequences. Yes, Maoist communism did have health care for everybody. It had schooling for everybody. It had guaranteed income for everybody. China has also experienced the world's largest population growth of any country in the world, sitting now at about 1.6 billion people. So in that security that the Maoist environment provided, did it also provide basically a breeding ground for Chinese to reproduce and then become the world's most populous nation?
Well, I mean, part of what happened, first of all, it's not 1.6 billion. It's more like 1.2 billion now, maybe edging up toward 1.3. Yes, there was very large population growth during the Mao years, in part because the health system, even for poor peasant families, was enormously increased. So together with general food security, though you had these terrible events around the Great Leap Forward, around 1960, 1961, where there were probably millions of deaths, but that was a 2 or 3 year period. The rest of the time, peasants were gaining in their general security and especially their health care. And one of the results of that was very rapid population growth. That's part of why when Deng Xiaoping came in, they put in the one-child policy to try and limit that growth, because they felt that if it continued uncontrolled, it would undercut the economic advances that they were trying to make.
Well, that was very far-sighted, and perhaps time is going to tell whether that prediction actually remains true. We're talking to Robert Weil, everybody. Robert, let me change subjects on you here and ask you a question. In what ways is China's capitalistic system with centralized regime, how much does the centralized regime play in their capitalistic system over there right now?
It still plays a very heavy role, and the contrast with the U.S. is in many ways striking. Basically, it's still a quasi-planned economy in the sense that the central government is able to direct resources to both parts of the country geographically and to sectors of the economy that it wants to build up. For instance, they're plugging a great deal of money now into the new green technology. And they're actually able to develop those parts of both the economy and the society in geographic terms because they still have this ability, you know, as a government to implement certain kinds of planned activity. You know, in the United States at this point, we have essentially just a chaotic, you know, private capitalist, winner-take-all kind of approach to all of this, where our roads are falling apart and we can't develop a high-speed rail system. And, you know, Obama called for some of this last night, but we're already years behind what countries like China, not just China, are already doing.
Well, a very interesting point, and I'm glad you brought up the whole issue of pollution, Robert, because that was a direction that I want to go down. You know, it's been 21 years since Tiananmen Square. China's going to have 200 cities with more than a million people in population. Air pollution and water pollution are rampant there. Will the communist government be able to deal with these industrial and urban problems, or will the Chinese government be forced more and more towards a democratic economy?
Well, it's two different questions.
Well,
but okay, let me try and address both of them. The pollution problems in China are extreme. The environmental problems of various kinds are extreme, in part because while they have this ability to set policies at the national level, when you get down to the regional level, the provincial level, and especially the local level, a lot of these things don't get implemented. There's enormous corruption, governments colluding with business to do whatever they want. And one of the results of that is that a lot of the environmental aspects get negated at the local level. And China does have enormous problems in that regard with water pollution, air pollution, you know, you name it. On the other hand, they are, in many ways, investing in and undertaking environmental projects that, again, are really beyond what the United States is doing. So it's a kind of, you know, strange combination of neglect and great problems on one side, but also very heavy investment and efforts to deal with some of those on the other side. And I don't think we know yet, you know, which way that's going to come out. It's undoubtedly going to be something of a mixed bag as to where all of this goes. They're the biggest market for cars now. They have stricter auto standards than we have, but there's, you know, tremendous problems with air pollution, et cetera.
Hmm.
As far as the democratic process, again, I don't think we really know. There's certainly some pressure to move toward, you know, a more open democratic society. There's a lot of feeling of that kind, but it doesn't necessarily take the form of people wanting to have a Western-style, you know, parliamentary or congressional-type system. There are people in China and the urban centers, Western-oriented intellectuals who call for that kind of thing. But I would say they're probably a pretty small minority. There is a lot of pressure for greater transparency, for greater democratic control of local governments in particular, for more media freedom, for more right to demonstrate, etc. There's a lot of that kind of pressure. But you have to remember that the background in China is the Mao era. It's not, you know, Jeffersonian democracy. And a lot of working people feel that they actually had a bigger voice during the Mao era than they have now. It may not look like Western democracy, but they had, you know, real control to some extent over, for instance, their working places. And they've lost that now. So a lot of them are looking backward, at least as much as they're looking, you know, to the West, probably more so. For, you know, ideas as to how they can reorder Chinese society at this point to make it more open and democratic, but not necessarily along the lines that, you know, the U.S. would advocate.
Well, very interesting perspective. We're talking to Robert Weil, everybody, author of the book Red Cat, White Cat. And Robert, just recently, China trotted out its weaponry. They had a display of weaponry right before the United States paid a visit to China, including a stealth fighter that they had on display. In what ways is China using the buildup of arms to foster economic growth?
Oh, I don't have the sense that they're particularly using it to foster economic growth. I mean, I'm sure it contributes to some extent, but I think it's from their standpoint, it's basically defensive. The United States is still, you know, the U.S. Navy patrols off China's shore. The U.S. is still providing arms to Taiwan. China's concerned about protecting its sea routes, especially for things like oil. So it definitely is building up, and it's beginning to project its military power as well as its economic power into a wider and wider area. And this is challenging the domination of the United States in East Asia and even to some extent like in South Asia. And the U.S. military is very worried about this. From the Chinese standpoint, their military budget is still, at most, probably a tenth of what the United States is. And they see themselves still, having been semi-colonized for 100 years, as essentially in a defensive posture against U.S. power. So they are projecting more, and some people think they have their own imperialist ambitions at this point. Again, I think that remains to be seen just how far that goes.
Well, let me ask you to look at this from a historical perspective. The Soviet Union and the United States got into a great arms buildup, and of course, some would argue that that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Do you think that there's a building arms race between the United States and China that might cause China to implode the same way that the Soviet Union imploded?
I think it's more likely to cause the United States to implode, frankly. China's got lots of money. The U.S. is the one that is stripping its domestic infrastructure and its schools and its health care and everything else to pay for a military budget that's as large as the rest of the world combined. The Chinese are sitting on more money than they almost know what to do with, and they're doing both things. I mean, they're pouring enormous funds into education and technology, et cetera, while they're also doing this military buildup. So, no, I don't see China imploding because of its military expenses, which are still very modest compared to the United States. I think our country's the one that's really in trouble over this issue because, you know, we insist on fighting two wars and basically running the world, and we don't have the money to do it anymore.
Great. We're talking to Robert Weil, author of the book Red Cat, White Cat. Robert, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book, Red Cat, White Cat?
Well, it's a decade and a half old now. It came out in 1996. But the basic point of the book is the contrast between the socialistic aspects of the Mao era and what was at that point still coming in, especially the area of China where I was, of the new capitalistic form of organizing society. And what I was largely dealing with, though there are other parts of the book, is the contrast between those two systems and the effect of that on the working classes in particular. And the kinds of gains that I talked about earlier that working people had achieved in China in the socialist era, which I felt were being undermined by the new capitalist approach. I think that lesson still holds true. At that time, nobody foresaw the enormous growth that China's made now, and that certainly has had its own impact in various ways, lifting, you know, some people out of poverty, etc. But as I said earlier, it's polarized the society in ways that also people never imagined could have happened.
Well, it's an interesting study.
You know, that's kind of the essence of the book.
Well, it's an interesting study, Robert. Now, if people are listening to the sound of your voice, they like what they hear, where would you direct them to go on the Internet to learn more about you and about your book?
The book can be obtained from Monthly Review Press. It's still, I believe, in print or, you know, online from other sources. The easiest way to look at some more of my work would be go to www.chinastudygroup.net, and there's a place where you can plug in my name and it'll bring up several of my articles.
That's chinastudygroup.net. Robert, thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you. Very good questions.
Thank you. And today is an exciting day. Coming up after ABC News at the top of the hour, we're going to be talking a little bit about Hollywood with one of the family members of the original founding family of Hollywood. We'll also be talking business, and towards the end of the hour, we'll be talking about World War II. For all of you veterans of World War II who are interested in the Battle of Britain, we'll be discussing that as well. Remember, tomorrow we've got Steve Forbes is going to be our special guest at 10:20. You'll want to tune in and listen for that interview. Steve Forbes is coming here to Ventura County. He's going to be giving a talk, but before he gives his talk, he'll be talking to us here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. As I said, coming up at the top of the hour is ABC News. And following that, we'll continue on with our theme today, which is history. We'll be talking the history of Hollywood, the history of business, and history of the Battle of Britain. Stay tuned and listen for that.